listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. I believe, and I hope you concur, that a good summer spy thriller is as delicious and as irresistible as a long, cool drink, shaken, not stirred. I'm thrilled to have Daniel Silva back with us on the program. His new Gabriel Lawn thriller is, and I'm going to gush here, absolutely fantastic. It's smart, believable, and as timely as a book can be. Reviewers agree that Silva is at the top of the spy game. There's some great cop dramas out now, too. They grab you and don't let you go till the last page. Some of today's titles are the latest episodes in popular series, and some offer up characters who are new but definitely worth knowing. Let's see what these talented writers have in store as we turn to page one of the book report. In The Director, a gripping new novel from David Ignatius, spies don't bother to steal information, they change it, permanently and invisibly. Graham Weber has been director of the CIA for less than a week when a Swiss kid in a dirty t-shirt walks into the American consulate in Hamburg. He announces the agency has been hacked, and he's got a list of agents' names to prove it. This could be the moment a CIA director dreads the most. Weber isn't sure where to turn until he meets James Morris, the CIA's in-house geek who runs the Internet Operations Center. Weber launches Morris on a mole hunt new to spy fiction, into the hacker underground of Europe and America. George Guidel performs the title that is a maze of deception and double dealing, a world where everything is written in zeros and ones, and nothing can be trusted.
An hour later, after Weber had unpacked his bag and made some business calls on the hotel phone back home to Seattle, the two men were in a taxi taking the short ride from Caesars across I-15 to the Rio, which was hosting the main events of the convention. Morris led the way. He changed into a black hoodie. On the way in, he got nods from occasional passers-by. Weber wondered whether these were other intelligence officers trolling for talent, or agents inside the hacker world, or perhaps just kindred spirits. They stopped to register at a VIP booth just outside the main convention area. Weber felt uncomfortable, watching the Mohawks and bullet heads walk past. Their T-shirts advertised their passion for undoing the ordered world. "Hackito ergo sum," read one. "Hack the cloud," boasted another. "Carnal knowledge of death," warned a third. A convention organizer handed Weber his entry badge. It was an odd-shaped device with plastic representations of Egyptian gods and mummies below an electronic pod with a circuit board packed with chips and transmitters. There was space for three AAA electric batteries on the back. Weber began to insert the batteries he'd been given as part of his registration kit. "Don't turn it on," said Morris. "It's a mini-computer that'll connect to the mesh network. It can track wherever you go here. It may have a camera and microphone. Leave it off. You're a speaker. You don't need the badge turned on. I'll get you through if there's any hassle." Weber put the odd-shaped device, unwired, around his neck and passed through the entry portal to respectful nods from the gatekeepers toward his guide. "I take it you've been here before," Weber said, joining the stream of the crowd entering the convention space. "I've been coming to DEF CON for 10 years, said Morris, leaning toward Weber and speaking quietly. "It's my favorite honeypot." "You recruit here?" asked Weber. "I've hired some of my best people off the floor." He pointed to an overweight, pimple-faced young man in baggy cargo shorts and sandals, and a goth girl shrouded in black who was sucking on a lollipop. "These people may not look like much, but when they write code, it's poetry." Weber nodded to Morris, as if to say, "I get it." This was why he had accepted the invitation to speak at the hacker convention. As a member of the Intelligence Advisory Board, he wanted to see the future of intelligence. He had asked the board's director if the intelligence community could suggest a smart young tech specialist who knew the scene. They had assigned him James Morris, who had already earned a reputation at the CIA's Information Operations Center for his technical prowess. "Come on, sir, I want to show you something scary," said Morris, leading the older man down a long, black-walled corridor to a crowded area at the center of the convention space. They moved through a knot of people who had dressed as if for a Halloween party. Eventually, they came upon a jumbo screen framed by cardboard cartoon cutouts of sheep standing in trench coats and sunglasses. On the screen was a scroll of names and numbers. "What the hell is this?" asked Weber. "It's called the Wall of Sheep." Morris pointed to the information scrolling above them in a continuous thread. "Those are the login names and passwords of people whose communications are being intercepted right now, in real time." Weber shook his head. His hand went to the cell phones in his pocket. "It's that easy?" he asked.
"This is slow. You should see what I can do with my machines at the agency."
We've just heard The Director by David Ignatius. John Vernon's novel, Let the Devil Sleep, features the most decorated homicide detective in NYPD history, Dave Gurney. Dave's trying to adjust to his life of quasi-retirement when a young woman seeks his counsel. She has been working on a documentary chronicling a notorious murder spree. Soon after, Gurney begins to feel threatened. A razor-sharp hunting arrow lands in his yard. Then he narrowly escapes injury in a booby-trapped basement. As things grow more bizarre, he finds himself re-examining the case of the Good Shepherd, which 10 years earlier had involved a series of roadside shootings and rages against the rich. Mocked by some who'd been his supporters in previous investigations, Dave realizes the killer is too clever to be found. The only gambit that may work is also the most dangerous. Dave must make himself a target and get the killer to come to him. Jeff Harding narrates.
The French doors were open. From where Dave Gurney was standing by the breakfast table, he could see that the last patches of winter snow, like reluctant glaciers, had receded from the open pasture and survived now only in the more recessed and shadowed places in the surrounding woods. The mixed fragrances of the newly exposed earth and the previous summer's unmowed hay drifted into the big farmhouse kitchen. These were smells that once had the power to enthrall him. Now, they barely touched him.
"You should step outside," said Madeline from where she stood at the sink, washing out her cereal bowl. "Step out into the sun. It's quite glorious."
"Yes, I can see that," he said, not moving.
"Sit and have your coffee in one of the Adirondack chairs," she said, setting the bowl down in the drying rack on the countertop. "You could use some sun."
He nodded meaninglessly and took another sip from the mug he was holding. "Is this the same coffee we've been using?"
"What's wrong with it?"
"I didn't say anything was wrong with it."
"Yes, it's the same coffee."
He sighed. "I think I'm getting a cold. Last couple of days, things haven't had much taste." She rested her hands on the edge of the sink island and looked at him.
"You need to get out more. You need to do something."
"Right."
"I mean it. You can't just sit in the house and stare at the wall all day. It will make you sick. It is making you sick. Have you called Connie Clark back?"
"I will."
"When?"
"When I feel like it." He didn't think it was a feeling he was likely to have in the foreseeable future. That's just the way he was these days. The way he'd been for the past 6 months. It was as though, after the injuries he'd suffered at the end of the bizarre Gillian Perry murder case, he had withdrawn from everything connected with normal life. Daily tasks, planning, people, phone calls, commitments of any kind. He'd gotten to the point where he liked nothing better than a blank calendar page for the coming month. No appointments, no promises. He'd come to equate withdrawal with freedom. At the same time, He had the objectivity to know that what was happening to him wasn't good, that there was no peace in his freedom. He felt hostile, not serene. To some extent, he understood this strange entropy that was unwinding the fabric of his life and isolating him. Or at least he could list what he believed to be its causes. Near the top of the list, he'd placed the tinnitus he'd been experiencing since he emerged from his coma. In all likelihood, it had actually begun 2 weeks before that, when 3 shots were fired at him in a small room at nearly point-blank range. The persistent sound in his ears, which the ear, nose, and throat specialist had explained wasn't a sound at all, but rather a neural anomaly that the brain misinterpreted as sound, was hard to describe. The pitch was high, the volume low, the timbre like a softly hissed musical note. The phenomenon was fairly common among rock musicians and combat veterans, was anatomically mysterious, and apart from occasional cases of spontaneous remission, was generally incurable. Frankly, Detective Gurney, the doctor had concluded, considering what you've been through, considering the trauma and the coma, ending up with a mild ringing in your ears is a damn lucky outcome. It wasn't a conclusion Dave could argue with, but it hadn't made it any easier for him to adjust to the faint whine that enveloped him when all else was silent. It was a particular problem at night. What in daylight might resemble the harmless whistling of a tea kettle in a distant room became in the darkness a sinister presence, a cold metallic atmosphere that encased him.
We've just heard Let the Devil Sleep by John Verdon. Daniel Silva is one of the truly great American spy novelists. Daniel burst onto the scene in 1997 with his electrifying debut, The Unlikely Spy, a novel of love and deception set around the Allied invasion of France in World War II. His second and third novels, The Mark of the Assassin and The Marching Season, starred two of Silva's most memorable characters, CIA officer Michael Osborne and international hitman Jean-Paul Delaroche. But it was Silva's fourth novel, The Kill Artist, which would alter the course of his career. The novel featured a character described as one of the most memorable and compelling in contemporary fiction, the art restorer and sometimes Israeli secret agent, Gabriel Alon. The heist is 14th in the Gabriel Alon series, and it is, quite simply, an incredible read. Welcome, Daniel. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
What I find so extraordinary is that Gabriel's expertise never spills over into superhero caricatures. Your books are so incredibly smart.
I appreciate that. You know, he's a little bit larger than life, and when necessary, he can be do things that ordinary mortals might not be able to do. But generally, I like to populate the story with believable, real characters, and that the combination of these believable, real characters make extraordinary thing happen on the page.
Right. The heist is so current, it's so pertinent. It seems like you wrote it based on yesterday's events, so congratulations.
I'm cursed, I suppose, with being on a very tight deadline, and I've never been one of these writers that's been able to get, you know, a manuscript or two ahead. And I actually finished the final revisions on this book, believe it or not, on June 1st. And so for better or worse, I do, have the ability to keep the books very current in terms of what's really going on in the world.
Right. This book begins with an art theft of a Caravaggio nativity. And it's based on an actual theft, is that right?
That is correct. It is the Caravaggio's nativity with St. Francis and St. Lawrence, one of his final great altarpieces, He painted it in Palermo when he was on the run, wanted for murder. It hung in a small chapel in the center of Palermo until a evening in October 1969, when two thieves entered the chapel, got it from its frame, and no one other than the thieves has seen it since.
You share a really surprising statistic in the book. Each year, thousands of pieces of art go missing, and the value of the stolen pieces is estimated at $6 billion, making art crime the fourth most lucrative illicit activity in the world. Talk right. about that.
Well, it is, as I wrote in the book, I mean, it is an extraordinarily large sum of money. It's not all paintings, but paintings, other objects of art, $6 billion. And so it's, I guess, drug trafficking, arms trafficking, money laundering, and then art crime. And so I think for a long time, people tended to dismiss art crime as sort of a crime against the rich, but it really isn't. But more importantly, I mean, each time a thief makes off with an iconic piece of work, a little piece of our history gets taken. And, you know, the odds of recovering a painting once it's stolen are extremely small, 1 in 10. So unfortunately, when a painting is gone, it generally stays gone.
You described stolen art as traveler's checks for the criminal class. Is this based on fact?
A lot of art does sort of stay in the hands of criminal gangs and gets circulated back and forth between criminal gangs. And it's oftentimes it's used as down payments or collateral in other criminal transactions. So a criminal gang that's buying a load of heroin from Turkey, for example, might hand over a Van Gogh or a Picasso as collateral. And so that's one way that art circulates through the criminal underworld.
The heist puts the spotlight on Syria and the Assad family. Can you tell us why you wrote about this right now?
Well, I didn't actually name the Assad family in the book. They are unnamed rulers of Syria. But I think that one of the most interesting aspects of the, Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening, is the way that it laid bare the personal finances of some of these rulers. I lived in Egypt. I knew that President Mubarak was a wealthy man, but it was estimated that, at the time he was driven from power, that he was worth $70 billion. Muammar Gaddafi was worth at least that much, if not more. And the Assad family is also worth billions and billions of dollars. That is money that was not spent on their people. That is money that was looted, diverted through other shady deals. And there are governments that are looking for it, professional assets hunters are looking for it. And if we can get control of that money, we might be able to influence their behavior.
You're listening to Daniel Silva on The Book Report. The Arab Spring briefly held the promise of change in the Middle East, but sadly, it seems to have reverted back to old ways. Do you see any indication of a more optimistic outcome?
I am hopeful, and I think that we have to hope. Otherwise, it's just too gloomy. But I'm afraid that things are going to get worse before they get better. In fact, I'm almost certain of it. So we have a long way to go before the Arab world sorts itself out, unfortunately.
There's a character in the book, Jihan Nawaz. Tell us her story a bit, and also Hama rules.
Well, Jihan Nawaz is a young woman who works at a private bank in Linz, Austria. The bank is co-owned by a man from Syria who is involved in concealing assets of the Syrian ruling family. And Hama rules, where she comes from, the town of Hama. Hama rules refers to the massacre that took place in Hama in 1982. There was an uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood in Hama. The Assad regime responded with absolute brutality, destroyed the town, killed about 20,000 people. And afterwards, that response became known as Hama rules, meaning that if you rise up against me, I'm going to respond with just unrelenting fury and violence. And I think Hama rules was a predictor and a precursor of what would happen when when the Arab Spring finally arrived in Syria.
This book has scenes in Austria, Corsica, Geneva, and of course Israel. Did you travel extensively while preparing to write?
Absolutely. I always do. I always visit the places that I write about. And this book was no exception.
Oh, it seems like you've laid the groundwork here for Gabriel to take over his agency. Is that going to happen in the next adventure, and are you already at work in it?
I learned a long time ago not to discuss a book that hasn't been written, but he is going to be a father soon, and he is going to be the chief of Israeli intelligence soon. That's all I can say.
Do you ever consider writing a non-Gabriel thriller in the near future?
I do, but, the series is, quite frankly, so wildly successful and is still growing that if I did that, I think that there'd be an uprising among my readers. And so for the moment, I plan to continue writing Gabriel.
Oh, we're very glad.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thanks. Bye, Daniel. And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Heist, performed by George Guidall.
Gabriel knew a good restaurant not far from the church, in a quiet corner of Castello where tourists rarely ventured. General Ferrari ordered lavishly. Gabriel moved food around his plate and sipped at a glass of mineral water with lemon. "You're not hungry?" inquired the general. "I was hoping to spend a few more hours with my Veronese this afternoon." "Then you should eat something. You need your strength." "It doesn't work that way." "You don't eat when you're restoring?" "Coffee and a bit of bread." "What kind of diet is that?" "The kind that allows me to concentrate." "No wonder you're so thin." General Ferrari went to the antipasti trolley and filled his plate a second time. There was no one else in the restaurant, no one but the owner and his daughter, a pretty dark-haired girl of 12 or 13. The child bore an uncanny resemblance to the daughter of Abu Jihad, the second in command of the PLO, whom Gabriel, on a warm spring evening in 1988, had assassinated at his villa in Tunis. The killing had been carried out in Abu Jihad's second-floor study, where he had been watching videos of the Palestinian Intifada. The girl had seen everything. 2 immobilizing shots to the chest, 2 fatal shots to the head, all set to the music of Arab rebellion. Gabriel could no longer recall the death mask of Abu Jihad, but the young girl's portrait, serene but seething with rage, hung prominently in the exhibition rooms of his memory. As the general retook his seat, Gabriel concealed her face beneath a layer of obliterating paint. Then he leaned forward across the table and asked, "Why me?"
"Why not you?"
"Shall I start with the obvious reasons?"
"If it makes you feel better."
"I'm not an Italian policeman. In fact, I'm quite the other thing."
"You have a long history here in Italy."
"Not all of it pleasant."
"True," agreed the general. "But along the way you've made important contacts. You have friends in high places like the Vatican. And perhaps, more importantly, you have friends in low places too. You know the country from end to end. You speak our language like a native, and you're married to an Italian. You're practically one of us."
"My wife isn't Italian anymore."
"What language do you speak at home?"
"Italian," admitted Gabriel.
"Even when you're in Israel?" Gabriel nodded. I rest my case. The general lapsed into a thoughtful silence. This might surprise you, he said finally, but when a painting goes missing, or someone gets hurt, I usually have a pretty good idea who's behind it. We have more than 100 informants on our payroll, and we've tapped more phones and email accounts than the NSA. When something happens in the criminal end of the art world, there's always chatter. As you say in the counterterrorism business, nodes light up. And now? The silence is deafening. What do you think it means? It means that in all likelihood, the men who killed Jack Bradshaw were not from Italy. Any guess as to where they're from? No, the general said, shaking his head slowly. But the level of violence concerns me. I've seen a lot of dead bodies during my career, but this one was different. The things they did to Jack Bradshaw were... His voice trailed off, then he said, medieval. And now you want me to get mixed up with them. You strike me as a man who knows how to take care of himself. Gabriel ignored the remark. My wife is pregnant. I can't possibly leave her alone. We'll keep a close eye on her. The general lowered his voice and added, we already are. It's good to know the Italian government is spying on us. You didn't really expect otherwise, did you? Of course not. I didn't think so. Besides, Alon, it's for your own good. You have a lot of enemies. And now you want me to make another one.
We've just heard The Heist by Daniel Silva. Oh, the book report likes to mix it up a bit. Here's a just-released nonfiction title with the twists and turns worthy of any spy thriller we're previewing today. In Operation Shakespeare, the true story of an elite international sting, investigative journalist John Schiffman traces a high-risk undercover op launched by Homeland Security, a unit created to stop the Iranians, Russians, Chinese, Pakistanis, and North Koreans from acquiring American-made electronics capable of guiding missiles, jamming radar, and triggering countless weapons. The U.S. agents must outwit not only enemy brokers, but also American manufacturers and global bankers willing to put profit over national security. The three-year sting climaxes when U.S. agents lure an Iranian broker to a former Soviet republic with the promise of American-made radar, a fighter jet, and missile components. They secretly drag him back to the States. His laptop provides the CIA with a virtual roadmap to Tehran's clandestine efforts to obtain U.S. military technology. David Drummond narrates.
A name that sounded Persian, but could be Baltic. Sleep-deprived and adrenaline-fueled, Darius fought to remain focused. He had waited on a target in this manner countless times, and knew this would be his last major operation. Today's mark was arriving from Tehran. Darius had the man's name, but no picture. He scanned the airport foyer for Iranian counter-surveillance. Nothing stood out. But this was the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, birthplace of Stalin, and the legacy of KGB intrigue lingered. A veteran of the Cold War, Darius carried in his wallet official-looking documents identifying himself as an East European arms broker, yet he was neither European nor a spy. Darius was a cop, an undercover agent from U.S. Homeland Security. Outside the airport entrance, an undercover Georgian policeman, playing the part of Darius's driver, waited beside a black Mercedes SUV with crimson window curtains. Embedded inside the car's rearview mirror were a camera and a microphone, ready to record conversations during the ride downtown. In the terminal, a dour Georgian from the Ministry of Internal Affairs pulled close and discreetly slipped Darius the flight manifest. He skimmed the 2-page passenger list until he recognized a name. Darius suppressed a smile, folded the document, and gave a silent signal to his cover team. 35 miles south of Baghdad, near a city called Iskandaria, a cherub-faced second lieutenant from New Jersey set off with his platoon on a routine patrol. Seth Devorin commanded Outcast Platoon, 17 men stationed at a major power facility near the banks of the Euphrates River. Lieutenant Devorin was a Rutgers University graduate and 24 years old. This marked his fifth month in combat. Devorin's men ventured outside like this virtually every day, beyond the barbed wire and concrete fort, clearing roads in advance of long army convoys. They lugged M4 carbine rifles, M249 light machine guns, and 70 pounds of gear, sometimes in Humvees, sometimes on foot, always alert for deadly handmade roadside bombs, or IEDs, shorthand for improvised explosive devices. The enemy hid IEDs everywhere, inside abandoned tires, paint cans, concrete chunks, dead dogs, boxes of candy, mannequins, behind signs and posters. The Army trained soldiers like Lieutenant Devorin to scan for danger signs, fresh piles of dirt in a roadway, odd objects hanging from trees and electrical poles, or sudden insurgent signals, a flare launch, blinking lights from a nearby home, a single gunshot fired as a convoy entered a village. Lieutenant Devorin also learned to look for things that weren't there. Odd situations, like the absence of children in a place where kids usually played, or a cafe, busy one day, vacant the next. The enemy triggered IEDs in three ways, by detonating cord, timer, or remote control. The wired cords were, of course, easier to spot, and sometimes the remote control triggers could be thwarted by radio wave jammers mounted on the Humvees. But lately, U.S. soldiers in Iraq were discovering more sophisticated remote timers and triggers inside the IEDs, including, incredibly, products manufactured in American factories. Insurgents in both Iraq and Afghanistan were acquiring American-made components to help kill U.S. soldiers. And the growing evidence showed that Iran was smuggling the IED parts from the United States to the battlefield. Devorin and his men didn't disarm the roadside bombs. They spotted them and radioed experts from disposal units. They didn't always see them in time. In Iraq and Afghanistan, at least 2,500 U.S. soldiers have died in IED attacks, accounting for nearly half of the total killed by hostile fire. In the coming months, 7 of the 17 men in Lieutenant Devorin's platoon would be gravely wounded. 3 would die, killed by remote control IEDs.
We've just heard Operation Shakespeare by John Schiffman. Paris, 1938. As the shadow of war darkens Europe, democratic forces on the continent struggle against fascism and communism. In Spain, the war has already begun. Alan Furst's Midnight in Europe is a taut, suspenseful novel of secret operatives in Paris, New York, Warsaw, and Odessa on the eve of World War II. Christian Ferrar, a brilliant Spanish émigré, is a lawyer in the Paris office of a prestigious international law firm. Ferrar is approached by the embassy of the Spanish Republic and asked to help a clandestine agency trying desperately to supply weapons to the Republic's beleaguered army, an effort that puts his life at risk in the battle against fascism. Daniela Giroux performs this spellbinding portrait of a continent marching into a nightmare.
On a soft winter evening in Manhattan, the 15th of December, 1937, it started to snow. Big flakes spun lazily in the sky, danced in the lights of the office buildings, and melted as they hit the pavement. At Saks Fifth Avenue, the window displays were lush and glittering. Tinsel, toy trains, sugary frost dusted on the glass, and a crowd had gathered at the main entrance, drawn by a group of carolers dressed for a Dickens Christmas in long mufflers, top hats, and bonnets. Here then, for as long as it lasted, was a romantic New York. The New York in a song on the radio. Christian Ferrar, a Spanish émigré who lived in Paris, took a moment to enjoy the spectacle, then hurried across the avenue as the traffic light turned red and began to work his way through the crowd. In a buckled briefcase carried under his arm, he had that morning's New York Times. The international news was as usual. Marches, riots, assassinations, street brawls, arson. Political warfare was tearing Europe apart. Real war was coming. This was merely the overture. In Spain, political warfare had flared into civil war, and, the Times reported, the army of the Republic had attacked General Franco's fascist forces at the Aragonese town of Teruel. And you only had to turn the page, there was more. Hitler's Nazi Germany had issued new restrictions on the Jews, while here was a photograph of Benito Mussolini, shown by his personal rail car as he gave the stiff-armed fascist salute, and there a photograph of Marshal Stalin reviewing a parade of tank columns. Christian Farrar would force himself to read it, would ask himself, is there anything to be done? Is it hopeless? So it seemed. Elsewhere in the newspaper, a democratic opposition to the dictators tried not to show fear, but it was in their every word, the nervous dithering of the losing side. As Franco and his generals attacked the elected republic, the others joined in, troops and warplanes provided by Germany and Italy, and with every victory they boasted and bragged and strutted. It's our turn, get out of our way. Or else. He'd had a long, long day. A lawyer with the Couder Frère law firm in Paris. He'd spent hours at the Couder brothers' home office at 2 Rector Street. There had been files to read, meetings to attend, and confidential discussions with the partners as they worked on matters that involved both the Paris and the New York offices, whose wealthy clientele had worldwide business interests and, sometimes, eccentric lives. Couder had, early in the century, famously untangled the Byzantine affairs of the son of Jacques Le Baudy. Le Baudy père had earned millions of dollars, becoming known as the Sugar King of France, but the son was another story. On receipt of his father's fortune, he'd gone thoroughly mad and led a private army to North Africa and there declared himself Emperor of the Sahara. In time, the French Foreign Legion had sent the Emperor packing, and he'd wound up living on Long Island, where his wife shot and killed him. But the difficulties of the Le Baudy case were minor compared to what Couder had faced that day. The legal hell created by the Spanish Civil War, now in its 17th month. Individuals and corporations cut off from their money, families in hiding because they were trapped on the wrong side, whatever side that was. Burnt homes, burnt factories, burnt records, with no means of proving anything to insurance companies or banks or government bureaucracies. The Couder lawyers in Paris and New York did the best they could, but sometimes there was little to be done. We regret your misfortune, monsieur, but the oil tanker has apparently vanished. Farrar had left the Couder office at 5:30 and headed uptown to his hotel, the Gotham. Then, as a favor to a friend at the Spanish embassy in Paris, he'd walked over to the Spanish Republic's arms-buying office at 515 Madison Avenue. Here he'd picked up 2 manila envelopes that he would take back to Paris. The days when you could trust the mail were long gone. He went next to Saks, meaning to buy Christmas presents, a hammered silver bracelet and a cashmere sweater, for a woman friend he was to meet at 7. This love affair had gone on for more than 2 years, as every 3 months or so he flew to Lisbon, where one could take the Pan Am flying boat to New York.
That was Midnight in Europe by Alan First. Tom Harper is just out with Zodiac Station. Plowing through the Arctic Ocean, the U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker Terra Nova is battering its way through the pack ice. There shouldn't be anyone near them for hundreds of miles. But then, a lone skier, half dead with cold, emerges out of the snow. His name is Tom Anderson, and he's the only survivor of a disaster at Zodiac Station, a scientific research base deep in the Arctic Circle. He tells an incredible story of scientists and spies, of lust and greed, jealousy, mayhem, and murder. But his tale doesn't add up. It's clear more was going on at Zodiac Station than Anderson is telling. And someone else may have survived the disaster. Someone who has killed before and is set to kill again. Piers Wehner narrates.
USCGC Terra Nova. Crew, 81 Coast Guard, 33 civilians. Mission, scientific support. Position, Nansen Basin, Arctic Ocean. What the hell is out there? Carl Franklin, captain of the U.S. Coast Guard icebreaking cutter Terra Nova, stared out the wheelhouse windows. A 360-degree field of view, but he might as well have his nose pressed against a painted wall. The clouds had settled after the storm, fusing the sky with the air and the air with the ice to make a perfect blank. Growing up in Maine, he thought he'd seen fog, but this was like nothing else. Even the bow light wasn't much more than a rumor. He put his hand against the cold glass, just to touch something solid. Hopefully the crew didn't notice. In the middle of the Arctic Ocean, 1,000 miles of ice around them and 4,000 meters of near-freezing water below the keel, he didn't want them thinking their captain was losing his grip on reality. He rocked back on his heels, reassured by the mass of 16,000 tons of steel under his feet. The Terra Nova was state-of-the-art, the pride of the Coast Guard, an ice-reinforced vessel capable of making a steady 3 knots through 4-foot ice, of smashing her way to the North Pole if need be. She'd already been there twice in her short working life. A wobbling reflection ghosted up out of the fog. Santiago, the operations officer, an Arizona Latino who traded his hot, landlocked state for a frozen ocean. A thing for deserts, was how he explained it. A thing for desserts, they teased him back. Franklin turned. The spooky Santiago in the window became the real deal, 6'2" of seafaring muscle, slowly being promoted to fat. By the time he had made Admiral, Franklin thought, the doctors would be giving him a hard time on his health assessment. The geeks want to go play, Santiago announced. The geeks were the scientists, the Terra Nova's cargo and her mission. 33 scientists from all over the world, measuring the water, measuring the ice, measuring the snow, measuring the air. 50 kinds of cold, Santiago called it. It kept them happy. What's the ice like? He called to the crewman hunched over the satellite chart. A tie-dye swirl of greens, oranges and reds, constantly mutating as the ice shifted. For fishing, sir. Franklin checked his watch. 10:30 at night. But that didn't mean anything here. The sun had come up 4 days ago and wasn't going to set for 5 months. Not that you'd know, with that damned fog. They can have 3 hours. He looked out the window again, at the blank, grey void that held the ship fast. They'd be lucky to measure their own feet in that. Put an extra man down there on bear guard. What the hell is out there? Bosun's mate, second class, Carl Aaron, hugged the Remington 870 to his chest and hoped he wouldn't have to use it in a hurry. The gloves made his fingers so fat he could hardly get them round the stock, never mind pull the trigger. Not that the gloves kept him warm, either. The only thing he could feel in his hands was prickling cold. He shouldered the shotgun and swung his arms to get some blood flowing. Behind him, the geeks did their thing on the ice. Some of them had put up a tripod and were using it to winch a yellow buoy down through a hole they'd bored. Others paced out survey lines, walking backwards and forwards over the snow, like they were checking for litter. Aaron, who'd scraped a D in 9th grade bio and spent 4 years of high school avoiding chemistry, wondered why they did it. He stamped his feet and wished they'd hurry the up. The fog had thinned a little. A ways back, the Terra Nova's red hull loomed over the ice, her white superstructure dissolving into the cloud. He could hear the rasp of the deck crew scraping off the ice and the low throb of her engine as the propellers turned slowly to maintain position. The yellow crane arm on her foredeck dangled the gangway onto the ice. He wondered how fast the scientists could run up it if a bear came.
That was Zodiac Station by Tom Harper. Now here's a thriller new to me, and one with, shall we say, a very unusual duo at its core. Paw and Order is the 7th book in Spencer Quinn's best-selling Chet and Bernie mystery series. This time out, canine narrator Chet and P.I. Bernie journey to Washington, D.C., the dog-eat-dog world of our nation's capital. Chet has been sniffing around the capital city and using his street smarts to uncover a devilish plot. Chet and Bernie pay a visit to Bernie's girlfriend, Susie Sanchez, a crack reporter living in D.C. She's working on a big story she can't talk about, but when her source, a mysterious Brit with possible intelligence connections, runs into the worst kind of trouble, Bernie suddenly finds himself under arrest. Stephen King has called Chet a canine Sam Spade full of joie de vivre. Let's give this a listen as Jim Frangione narrates.
We hopped out of the Porsche. Me actually hopping, Bernie using the door, and walked toward T.Pierre's Cajun BBQ. They had a deck on one side, so that was where we headed. Restaurant decks usually being pretty welcoming to me and my kind. We took the last empty table, all the others occupied by biker guys and gals, and Bernie ordered. Beer for him, water for me, ribs and brisket to share. A biker at the next table leaned toward us. "That your Porsche out there?" Bernie nodded. I'd been about to lie down in the shade under the table. Instead, I sat up nice and straight. The biker leaned a little closer. One of those dudes with a neck thicker than his head. Not a look that shows humans at their best, in my opinion. "Piece of crap," he said. He had the most interesting breath I'd smelled in a long time. A rich mix of onions, garlic, pulled pork, whiskey, pot, cocaine, rotten teeth, and strawberry ice cream. "This is America," Bernie said. "You're welcome to your opinion." The biker dude turned to the biker gal beside him. Hey, she had the same kind of neck, thicker than her head. Had I ever seen that on a woman before? I was trying to remember when the biker dude spoke in a high little voice. "You're welcome to your opinion." The biker gal thought that was funny. So did a bunch of the other bikers, all of them now looking our way. "My point exactly, pretty boy," the biker said, now back to his normal voice, rough and loud. "This is America." "Pretty boy." Was he agreeing with me that Bernie had the best face of the world? I went back and forth on that. Meanwhile, the biker dude was saying, "Your piece of crap ride in American, making you a traitor, as well as a sexual deviator." It got very quiet out on the deck at T.Pierre's Cajun BBQ. So when Bernie spoke, every word was clear. "You're embarrassing yourself," he said. It got even quieter. I heard the sounds of chairs being pushed back a bit and feet getting gathered underneath dudes. Dudes maybe planning to rise in a hurry. The thick-necked biker's face was real red now, and his nostrils had opened up a surprising amount, reminding me of a bull I came across once in a corral I'd regretted entering almost immediately. "Tell you what," he said, "I'll give you a choice. I can either beat the shit out of you here and now." "Yeah, do that, Ferdy," called someone from another table. "Or you can put those airy-fairy wheels of yours up against me and my Harley. Say, from here to the Pontgrieve Bridge and back." He took out a fat wad, counted out some bills, and slapped them on our table. $1,000 says you lose. Another biker dropped in more money. "Make that $2,000. And one more biker. $3,000.
We've just heard Paw and Order by Spencer Quinn. Readers, these titles have come such a long way since Bond. James Bond. I know I found this summer's crop of spy thrillers absolutely riveting. Whatever your favorite genre, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for suggestions on this season's favorites. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.